The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Cochran, Judge Werke, Judge Wheelock, the Honorable Jean M. Cochran presiding.
Good morning. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. The next case on our calendar today is A22-1697, State of Minnesota by Spring Valley Friends, LLC et al. Versus Riley Purgatory Bluff Creek Watershed District and Pulte Homes of Minnesota. As you know, we are hearing this case by Zoom today. We are recording the oral argument. The recording will be available on our website within approximately 24 hours. And I'll just remind anyone who's watching that no other recordings of our oral argument are permitted except with the express prior permission of the Minnesota Court of Appeals. So we will proceed in the normal fashion. Each party will have 15 minutes for your primary argument, and appellant will have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal. There is a clock available or a timer available in the grid view, so you can see how much time you have remaining. And if there are any technical issues, I'll ask the marshal to stop the timer, but hopefully we won't experience any technical issues today. So with that, appellant, you can proceed when you're ready. Please introduce yourself and the party you represent at the beginning of your argument.
Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the court. My name is Miles Ringsred, and I represent the appellants in this matter who are asking this court to determine the point at which a decision by the Watershed District Board becomes final and ripe for appeal for the purposes of running the 30-day period prescribed for filing the appeal in Minnesota Statute Section 103D.537A. Respondents in the watershed assert that the 30-day period begins to run at the instant the Water Board votes in favor of its decision, and appellants assert that the 30-day period begins to run at the point where the record of decision is finalized and published. In this case—
Also, I just wanna make sure I'm clear on your argument. So do you agree that the statute 103D.537 unambiguously requires that the appeal must be filed within 30 days of the manager's decision?
Yes, but that's really where the contention comes down to, is sort of the definition of the word decision.
Okay,
and so,
thank you.
Okay, and so and in this case, our position is when the minutes of the board meeting in which the decision was made or given final approval, officially signed and published on the board's website, is when the 30 days begin. Clearly, we're wading into the waters of constitutional due process and response.
Well, and I just saw you yesterday, Mr. Ringsred. Nice to see you again today. you know, again, we have a statute, and if the statute is clear, why would we insert additional words to require something other than what's stated on its face?
First, I would
and
say
again, what rules, authority do and what authority do we have to do that as a reviewing court?
So the rules of statutory construction specifically forbid unconstitutional interpretations of legislative intent. So Minnesota Statute 645.17, in ascertaining the intention of the legislature, the courts may be guided by the following presumptions. Down to three, the legislature does not intend to violate the Constitution of the United States or of this state. And so there are two, constitutional process requires two things, notice of a decision and contents of that notice. And both
so,
of these—
with regard to your due process argument, though, there needs to be some constitutionally protected interest for due process to apply. And what constitutionally protected interest is it do appellants have in this proceeding? I didn't see that argument There was a general due process argument made in the brief, but I didn't see it tied specifically to appellants and why they have a due process right here, what life, liberty, or property interest is at stake here that would give rise to due process protections.
It would be the right to appeal. And there are a number of cases that I have that very clearly specify, and I'll quote this one case, Schulte v. Transportation Unlimited, Inc., 354 Northwest 2nd, 830. And in that case, quote, we have often stated that administrative agencies must observe the basic rules of fairness as to parties appearing before them. Even if there were no specific statutory requirement of notice, this principle would seem to require that adequate notice and opportunity to be heard be afforded. So,
but here they were at members of the group were at the hearing where the voice vote was taken, correct?
Yes, but this is applicable to is to be afforded the opportunity to be heard on appeal. Respondents' interpretation of the statutes and bylaws that the time for appeal begins to run at the moment of the vote gives zero requirements for any notice of the decision to interested parties. Well, the form and manner of notice.
You're basically arguing that we should read in to the statute language that an appeal of a permit decision must be filed within 30 days of notice of the manager's decision.
Yes.
And you would agree that the managers made a decision by voice vote to go ahead to approve the permit.
They made a decision, but it's not a final decision, which somewhat...
And you're arguing that the minutes are what turns that voice vote into a final decision?
The minutes signed after they've had their opportunity to amend and change which could change the very reasons and basis for their decision.
Let's talk about that a little way. I'm sorry, just to be clear, the minutes are, in your view, when the decision became final?
When
the minutes were approved.
Yes, when the minutes were approved and then published on their website. That provides, if you look at many of these cases, the statute sometimes prescribes notice be sent if it's fairly specific to a party. Notice is required to be sent to the individuals that are affected, or in a case like this where it's a little more general, typically publication is when that happens. And there are a number of examples of this in both environmental law, in Minnesota Environmental Policy Act. Once a decision is made, it has to be published on the EQB monitor. And as pointed out in appellant's brief, this really well falls under the contested case category in the Minnesota Administrative Procedures Act as well.
Well, that's a separate issue that I think we can talk about later, but sure. In terms of your contention that when the minutes are approved and published on the website, that's when the decision becomes final. It seems to me that the minutes are just a record of the proceeding. They are not a decision itself. Can you explain to me why that is not accurate?
I would this sort of wades us into sort of the content of notice requirement under due process. And so it's not just that the notice needs to be given to an interested party so that they are put on notice, but the content of that notice is also very important. And there are a number of cases which very specifically highlight this. One of them is Hecker v. Crow Wing County Board. That's 959 Northwest 2nd, 215. In that case, they stated, we recognize that applicants in Saldan were unable to make cogent decisions whether to launch an appeal until they received the written notice, because it was not until appellants received the order and findings that were made aware of the basis upon which the county made its decision. And so once the board makes its vote, it is undisputed that they have the opportunity to amend and change the minutes, which could...
It's undisputed that they have the opportunity to amend the amend and change the minutes, is there any legal authority you can point to that suggests that they could make a substantive change to the minutes? I'm not aware of any authority that would allow for a substantive change. I mean, the review of the minutes is to ensure that it's consistent with the proceedings that happened earlier, that there, it's an accurate reflection of those proceedings.
Sure. And in one of the cases, Ellis v. Blue Sky Charter School is sort of illustrative of this, where in this case, the individual, it's a school board decision, and an individual had an at-will agreement, and at the meeting acknowledged as much and said that it may be terminated without cause. After that hearing, he requested that the board correct and change those the statements that he made, which the board is able to do is, and this highlights the fact that the correction and amendment to the minutes could completely create or change the claims upon appeal. And the distinction with respect to this respondent's argument is it doesn't have to be a change that would reverse their decision. It just needs to be a change in the minutes and meetings, which would give the basis for being able to appeal something, such as in that Ellis case that I had had just mentioned.
But the minutes, you would agree, are a record of the proceeding. It's not an actual decision itself. The minutes don't make the decision.
No, but they finalize the basis and reason for what their decision is. Until then, they're subject to change. And until then, it would not be possible for individuals, even if they were present at the meeting, to know exactly what basis the decision was made under. And back to the Hecker v. Crow Wing case, they also said, we emphasize that the purpose of providing notice of the decision is to convey the required information and afford a reasonable time for those interested to prepare adequately to make their appearance. A final written decision document is necessary to provide an aggrieved person with definite legal cognizance of a county's decision regarding a variance request. Our interpretation also fulfills the legislative intent of providing aggrieved persons with a right to appear by ensuring aggrieved persons have clear notice of when the 30-day appeal period commences under statute. This case is quite clear to the point that a voice vote does not provide the requisite content of notice for an appeal to be made.
Ask one question. I authored that opinion, and I think you highlight some important parts of that opinion, but I think you have omitted that the statute at issue in that opinion includes different language than the statute that's at issue here. And that statute says after receipt of notice of the decision, the appeal period begins. Whereas here, the appeal period begins within 30 days of the manager's decision. There's no language about notice of the decision. So I'm not sure your reliance on Hecker is as strong as you contend it is. I'm not sure Hecker is as on point as you argue it is.
I would agree that it is in somewhat of a different context in the same way that you just described. However, that brings us back to the first requisite for due process, and that is a notice of decision. And again, in that Schulte v. Transportation Unlimited case, that even if there is no specific statutory requirement of notice, that principle requires that adequate notice and opportunity to be heard is given. Even it is a fundamental aspect of due process that these elements are there. And an elementary and I'm going to quote from that same case, an elementary and fundamental requirement of due process in any proceeding, which is to be accorded finality, is notice reasonably calculated under all circumstances to appraise interested parties of the pendency of the action and inform them the opportunity to present their objections. The board's voice vote simply lacks these prerequisites. It doesn't provide any concrete, finalized decisions of finality where a individual would be able to go to an attorney and say, here are the reasons, and this is why we can appeal this decision. So regardless of whether a statute specifically authorizes that, there is the requisite of notice within the confines of constitutional due process. And because this court needs to interpret this notice statute that we are considering here, that can't be unconstitutional. And if the Constitution requires those two elements, the only point in this process is when things have been finalized at the point when the minutes are signed and the and possibly published on the board's website.
Worky, did you have an additional question?
I did, but I changed my mind. I might ask on rebuttal if we get there. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. You'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Also, for respondent, you can proceed when you're ready.
Thank you, Your Honor. My name is Paul Reavers, and I represent the respondent, Riley Purgatory Bluff Creek Watershed District. We ask the court to affirm the district court's dismissal of this action on the basis that they failed to timely perfect their appeal pursuant to the plain language of the statute. They really are, as you listen to the comments of my colleague, they really are asking you to write new requirements into the statute that do not exist.
Mr. Reavers, appellant does raise a good point, though, about how is an interested person supposed to know exactly what decision was made without a written decision document? How are they supposed to know exactly what they are appealing if there's no written record of the decision?
Well, I guess this goes to their kind of new due process claim that really I didn't read into their briefs. But here, these folks were there. So if we look at, frankly, just as an application in this case, they had actual notice of the decision. And this is not a situation like under the county variance statute, which has specific requirements for findings and recording of an order. We don't have that. That's a different statutory scheme. That's the Hecker case that they've alluded to. Here, the public meeting shows, and again, the minutes show it was a vote to approve, and the minutes are in the record, and the minutes are simply, Manager Ziegler moved to approve permit 2021-012 based on staff recommendations, including staff stipulations conditions. That's the motion. It was seconded. That was approved.
In your view, the time for appeal started 30 days from the voice vote of that, right?
That's the decision. The statute does not indicate, receipt of notice of decision as the county variance statute or other various statutory schemes have. So the legislature specifically indicated the time frame starts from the date of the decision.
What if someone had a car accident on the way to the hearing or was sick and wasn't able to be at the hearing and didn't know what decision was made, or maybe they heard through the grapevine, but they didn't really have a way to know exactly what decision was made. How does this ensure that they have sufficient notice of a decision?
It's a matter of public record. I would say number one, all the meetings are a matter of public record. They're on, I believe, on YouTube. So they're there for individuals to observe, even the minutes that were approved. And again, the minutes are simply the official record of the proceedings. It's not a separate decision. And I believe they acknowledge that. And we can always think of different situations, but due process doesn't have to be perfect to be made. In other words, we can always think of a situation where maybe an unfortunate accident happened, but the United States Supreme Court, and I just want to point the court to the language out of, and this is Mullane, M-U-L-L-A-N-E versus Central Hanover Bank and Trust. This is 339 U.S. 306, 314, the 1950 United States Supreme Court case. And what the Supreme Court says there, for due process to be satisfied, there must be, quote, notice reasonably calculated under all the circumstances to apprise interested parties of the pendency of the action and afford them an opportunity to present their objections, close quote. That happened here, even in their pleadings. And this is a motion to dismiss, and the allegations in the pleading, they specifically recount how they participated in these proceedings and provided the objections to the board. So under the framework that the United States Supreme Court outlined, this easily satisfied due process under any circumstances, whether somebody could not make the meeting for whatever reason. It just has to be reasonably calculated, especially here when they have not identified any specific constitutional right. They have no protected property interest. And I believe that's the question Your Honor asked. And they have not identified that whatsoever. And frankly, that wasn't briefed anywhere that they had a protected property interest. And under the United States Supreme Court precedent, this satisfied due process. And the case, I want to point the court to, I think it gives some, it's an unpublished case actually cited by relators in their principal brief on page 16. This is in the matter of construction of drainage system in Burnham Creek watershed in 1997, unpublished decision from this court, but again, still dealing with the water law, and the argument there was, hey, you needed written notice. And this court said, we're not gonna write in requirements that the legislature did not put there. Their real dispute here, real claim is to ask the legislature to put in additional requirements, not to have this court read in requirements that are not there. And the court there also cited the Mullane case I'd cited too. And again, the court in Burham noted, Minnesota courts recognize that Mullane does not require actual notice of a proceeding or action, but rather notice reasonably calculated to inform parties of their opportunity to be heard. They had notice, they were heard, and they disagree with the decision. And again, they were there. There's no dispute that the representatives of this group were there and participated. And therefore, there is no due process claim here. And the statute is plain on its face. The decision was made on August 12th. They didn't file the appeal within the requisite 30 days. This should be a fairly, candidly, a very simple decision for the court to apply the statutory language and dismiss this case. This is not an environmental review case. There are different requirements for publication at the EQB. Those requirements are not part of a watershed district's decision. This is not a case under, it's governed solely by 103D.537. And again, they had 30 days, they didn't do it. Frankly, it should be that simple. I frankly have no other comments other than they didn't do it in 30 days and constitutional due process is fully satisfied. This case has been going on for a long time. And I do ask the court to affirm the decision. And that's all I have, Your Honor. Thank you.
Counsel, I have a couple questions for you mm-hmm. about the watershed district's own procedures mm-hmm. and policies. Mm-hmm. In your addendum at mm-hmm. page 9, it sets forth the procedures for reconsideration of mm-hmm. a permit decision. And 4.6 says, absent the timely filing of a notice of reconsideration of a condition or the grounds for denial, the decision on the application is final at issuance. Mm-hmm. And so I read that, well, correct me if I'm wrong, but that suggests to me that there is some decision that is issued before the decision. There is some document that's issued before the decision becomes final.
No, Your Honor, that the vote itself is the issuance of the decision. So there is no, the decision is final upon the vote itself. And it simply means that if there is a motion for reconsideration, which there was not here, the decision was final. And the decision is when it was made on August 12th.
And why is the word issuance used then? Because in other places in this procedural document, it talks about issuance of a permit. So is it possible to read that the district's decision on the application is final at issuance of the permit?
And again, I, the issuance of the permit is the vote, Your Honor, is how we read that.
But isn't a permit a physical document?
It's the decision itself. There may be a piece of paper, but the actual decision is the board's action on that item.
Okay. I don't know. The word issuance doesn't seem to fit very well when you're talking about an oral decision, but maybe you can explain why that word is used.
Well, again, I think the statute requires the decision. So I guess the word issuance is really what we have is 103D.537A. Again, an appeal of a permit decision or order must be filed within 30 days of the manager's decision. So there is no dispute. The decision was made on August 12th. So the appeal must be filed within 30 days of the decision. That's what the statute requires, and that didn't happen. So to the extent that there is any documentation that may or may not flow from that decision, the appeal 30-day appeal period is triggered by that statutory, that plain language of the statute.
And there isn't any statute that requires a written decision with regard to this type of permit decision?
There's not, Your Honor. And that's why I think the legislature did with respect to variances. The legislature was very clear. There's separate requirements for that. Like for instance, that's under 394.27 subdivision 8, where a board of adjustment must prepare a written decision and actually record it in the office of the county recorder. So that's subdivision 8, again, of 394.27. So there's a different statutory framework. And if the legislature wanted to impose those type of requirements, the legislature certainly could have done so, because it has done so in the variance statute, and they didn't do it here.
I have one more question.
Sure.
Can you point me to any case where or any statute where the appeal period starts at the time of a voice vote, other than any case addressing whether the appeal period starts at the time of a voice vote, or any other statute where the appeal period arguably starts at the time of a voice vote?
Well, I think it's, and again, I can't think of it off the top of my head, Your Honor. I think we have to focus on when the decision was made. That's what this legislature pointed to. And I think there's no dispute that the decision was actually made on August 12th. And the approval of the minutes simply is the official record that decision was actually made on August 12th.
Okay, thank you. Any further questions from the panel? All right, thank you, Council.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Ringsred, you'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. I first like to sort of clarify, I think maybe a point of confusion here. Respondents and Your Honors have kind of been talking about the constitutional due process being satisfied at the point of at the vote versus in our case, we're saying there was no constitutional satisfaction at the point of the appellants being able to appeal. So there's a distinction they may have satisfied the constitutional due process requirements for notice and opportunity to be heard at the voice vote at that point. So before the vote took place, the constitutional due process requirements were met. However, what we're arguing is different. We're arguing that after the voice vote, the constitutional due process requirements were not met. This is the requirement to be able to appear before this court, to be able to appeal it based on the finality of a record that has been approved and finalized. And so—
My question I was gonna ask before, and I just need to say it again, is that I think your case would be stronger if you had some prejudice, but you know, you've acknowledged that you had people that were there that heard what the vote is. Is there anything you can point to that surprised you in the minutes when they came as compared to the yes or the no vote? I mean, to me, it seems that, that's what the whole appeal is about, yes or no. If your people were present at the hearing, part of what you argue in your brief, I'm getting to a question. Part of what you argue in your brief is that you needed to figure out the basis for the decision. But they heard the basis for the decision, unless you're going to point to something that appeared in the minutes that was contrary to what was stated verbally.
Yeah, I think the presence at the hearing is a bit of a red herring. I think the practical aspect of this, of the district court and respondents' interpretation really highlights the absurdity of it. Their interpretation would, first of all, require that someone be, as the other justice mentioned, would require that they be physically present there at the voice vote when it takes place. The respondent said there could be some other opportunities and recordings of stuff, but due process does not place the burden on that individual to be there at the hearing to be able to appeal it.
Well, I understand your argument, but then it seems to be, you know, we have to look at all of the statutes and read them together. What's the point of even having an open meeting then? A person would just simply wait until something comes out in print, and that's your document to appeal from. I don't know that it has any logic in terms of what you're attempting to convince us to do.
Well, the purpose of being there or having those meetings would be to put things on the record, because as this court knows, the record on appeal will be what was put there. So if there are experts, if there are other things that would be wanted to be put on the record, that's why that is held. And so without some form of notice of any decision, physical presence at that meeting would have to be required. And to further confound that, if someone wasn't without their physical presence, the interested party would have no way to know the rationale or basis for the decision so that their counsel could make a reasonable or evaluate the grounds for a possible appeal. And this is also true with them at that meeting. They would have to memorize, transcribe, or record the meetings themselves, and then based on that, ascertain the reasons and basis the board made. There could be all sorts of things presented at those meetings, but they may only rely on a number of things. And those are the things that would be memorialized in a final writing further along in the process. And in practical sense, I'm trying to imagine, trying to draft a statement of the case for an appeal in these circumstances. If a client came into my office and asked me to appeal a decision that has not been put down in writing, would require me to completely agree with or take them at their word that the decision they said was made. And then I would also have to base my statement on the case on the memory of what the client ascertained the reasons were for the decision.
Minutes were done prior to the appeal period expiring, even if we assume the appeal period started on August 12th. Isn't that correct?
We are assuming the minutes, I guess that
weren't
would be
the minutes right. Approved in early September?
September 1st. So yeah, I believe it would be about 3 weeks. I mean, getting together a record and even deciding whether something that would require quite the a rush to be able to go through. And I mean, having to try to, and that I don't think there would be anything requiring that they have that meeting and finalize those minutes within that time period either. And so I can't think of anything. How would I approach that in trying to list specific issues proposed to be raised on appeal in a statement of case? It would be completely relying on these hypotheticals and the memory of the client coming in until these are memorialized. And the final minutes provide the rationale and basis for a decision so that the interested parties and their counsel can make these reasoned, evaluated decisions for a possible appeal. And until then, any arguments and claims are really hypothetical. And appellants are not requesting that the statute or bylaws be struck down. We're really requesting that they be interpreted within the existing framework and comply with constitutional due process requirements. That's what this boils down to. Are there any further questions? If not, I have nothing else to say.
Thank you to both counsel for your helpful arguments here today. The matter is submitted and we will issue our opinion within the statutory timeframe.
Thank you,
Your Honor. Have a good day.